Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm Tim Lightfoot. I'm your host as we bring you interesting people in the world of sports medicine and oftentimes in general health as well that deal with exercise. This week, as I always say, is no exception. We are pleased to have with us Dr. William Hale, who's an assistant professor in human performance from Prairie View A&M University, just a little bit south here of Texas A&M. Welcome to the podcast today, William.
Great to be here, Tim. Big fan of the show and look forward to our conversation.
Thank you. And for the audience, Dr. Hale got his doctoral degree in health and human performance from Oklahoma State University, and he works in a variety of different research areas. We're going to talk a little bit about, I think, most of his research areas. We're going to talk about the cycling research he does and some of the stretching research and get into some of the interesting health disparities work in sports medicine that he does as well. But let's just crank off and let's talk about cycling. You are a cyclist by hobby and by research as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you know, Tim, one of the beauties of kind of marrying your passion with your occupation is that, you never really know if you're working or if you're having fun. And, cycling is definitely, one of those modes of exercise that can span a lifetime, and you can be as competitive or as recreational with cycling as you would like to be. And even in the state of Texas, we have a pretty strong racing competitive scene, and so that's been some of the population that I've used for a few studies that are kind of in the work for analyzing perceptions and behaviors amongst competitive cyclists.
And you are licensed as a professional cyclist, right?
Right. The United States Cycling Association categorizes racing from 1 to 5, and 5 being the most amateur. And there's also a master's category, and the master's category is 40 plus. And in order to be a Cat 1, which is that most elite form of racer, you have to earn a certain amount of points, and you have to upgrade through the categories. And that upgrade process varies based on your results, your race results and whatnot. So everybody starts off as a Cat 5 at some point, and depending on your, I guess we would say, physiological limitation and the time constraint, you can progressively move through the categories. And when you move towards the Cat 1 and Cat 2, that's when, the races become long and hard and a little more competitive in nature, so to speak.
So what category are you?
I race in the Cat 2, and okay. I think that that's probably because I've reached my physiological, peak. Plus, the Cat 1 racers traditionally get – paid to a certain extent, get stipends, and they have more time probably to train, which in cycling, whenever you're racing, long distances specifically, you have to allot quite a bit of time per week to for your training.
Now, I just want our audience to notice how humble William is about his accomplishment. He's a Cat 2 rider, which is like the next to the elite group. He's a full-time faculty member. And he does research in cycling. So, what's really cool is when you have a researcher that really knows what they're talking about when they do that. And so kudos to you. So how many miles a week do you wind up putting out on a bike?
Well, it varies, Tim. I think in the exercise world, whether you're a runner or whether you're a cyclist, we try and measure, the frequency and duration of our training by time versus in miles. And so...
Sure.
I really don't even know total miles because I'm always focused on hours. And, you know, you can race in the Cat 1-2 field probably, you know, training, you know, 8 to 12 hours a week. And, you know, the Cat 1 racers traditionally will probably train at 15-plus hours a week. Some may even train 20 hours a week. And when you get close to that many hours per week engaged in riding them, you have to – have probably a pretty flexible job and family position to do that.
Sure. So we come back to the question. So how many hours a week do you train on average?
If
you
had on average, probably like 9, you know, 9 to 10, and it depends on the season, you know, Tim. Yeah. Because you know, if you're preparing for an event, then you know you'll want to up your hours. Or if you're in the off season, you may want to, you know, put in maybe longer hours. And the whole periodization concept, you know, where we try and taper our mileage and up the intensity as we get closer to our competition or the race that we're, you know, possibly competing in. And, you know, this past weekend, there is a big, it's not a race, but it's a ride, and it's called the MS-150. And basically it's a two-day ride from mm-hmm. Houston to Austin. And there are a lot of just recreational riders who really, you know, train all year for that one weekend of riding, similar to somebody who may be targeting like the, you know, Austin or Houston Marathon. And so probably one of the coolest parts of cycling in general is that because it's low impact, you can really take almost any person and put them on a bike, and for one, they feel like they're a kid again, and two, all the, you know, ailments that possibly hurt them during, you know, maybe their running or brief athletic career kind of go away.
Yeah. There's certainly not a lot of impact, unless, of course, you hit the pavement.
Which at some point I think every cyclist does hit the pavement, and sometimes more severe than others, and I'm sure that some of the listeners have seen crashes on TV, and they can become pretty brutal.
Yeah.
It depends on how fast you're going. So,
well, the most embarrassing ones are when you come to a stoplight and forget that you're still clipped in. Your toes are still clipped in your pedals, and you wind up crashing just low speed right there, right?
I think everybody at one point has used the clipped-in pedals has done that. Even probably the most seasoned cyclist. Well,
you have an interesting thing in your background in that it's called cyclocross. Tell our audience what cyclocross is.
Well, cyclocross is a discipline of cycling in which you take a bike that's similar to a road bike. In fact, it looks almost exactly like a road bike, but it has kind of mountain bike-like tires on it. And cyclocross racing traditionally occurs not on the road or on the pavement, but on the grass or dirt, gravel road. And it's usually a, you know, a mile, 2 mile kind of course in which there are various obstacles along the way, such as, you know, mud pits or fallen trees in which you have to get off the bike, jump over, get back on the bike. So a lot of cyclocrosses, can you ride really fast, stop, or dismount from your bike while you're still running, grab the bike, throw it over your shoulder, jump the obstacle, put it, you know, jump back on the bike, and then clip in and then continue riding. So, you know, really hardcore cyclocross riders spend a lot of time practicing mounts and dismounts. So.
Hmm. So how's it different from mountain biking, what many people would think of as mountain biking?
Well, mountain biking traditionally would occur on a true mountain bike type of a course in which you have a single track type of a trail that you would ride on, and that would be a little longer of a loop than in cyclocross. Plus, you would be riding a mountain bike in which has probably a front and possibly a rear suspension, whereas the cyclocross bikes are fully rigid. So, you know, you have to be careful about your tire pressure because, you know, you don't want to be beat up whenever you're riding over some, you know, bumpy part of a gravel road and you're on a very rigid bike. So the bikes are different than mountain biking. Plus, in cyclocross, the races are usually about an hour long, where mountain bike races are traditionally a little longer than that.
Hmm. So it's like steeplechase in the horse.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way I usually explain it to people who haven't heard of it before. Is it is. It's very similar to like steeplechase or even cross country track where, you know, in the cross country meets, the athletes do have to sometimes jump over like barriers and run up these kind of steep inclines and run on various surfaces. So it's very popular down here in Texas, but really up in the Northeast and Northwest where you have epic conditions that, you know, generate like mud and snow. And that's kind of a real cyclocross race.
Yeah. So you you're saying you need mud and snow before you have a real race, huh?
Well, that's when people, true cyclocross racers think of cyclocross. They think, you know, well, it's not true cyclocross unless there's dirt involved and mud, and you're not filthy at the end of the race. So.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you've been involved with a bit, moving away from the cycling, is the whole argument about whether pre-activity stretching is good for you or not.
Now, so well,
people listening to this may go, what did he just say?
Yeah.
So we're going to turn it over to you. So tell us about this thought that maybe pre-activity stretching may not be necessary, needed, may not prevent injuries, or a variety of things that people say.
It's always one of those debated topics, Tim, that even with the students we have as far as, you know, is stretching really beneficial? And I always tell them, you know, you got to think about the timing of the stretch and what activity that you're stretching for. And so there's kind of conflicting views on, you know, the appropriate kinds of stretch before what, you know, various exercise you're engaged in. But what we kind of know, at least in the strength and power sports, is that stretching prior to a strength and power training event or competition can possibly reduce performance. And that's really due to a lot of the elastic properties of the muscles and the ligaments and the fascia. So Europeans have kind of been practicing this for a long time, I think. And American coaches sometimes fall into that, you know, area of where they kind of do what their old coach did. And so they're going to stretch their athletes possibly right before they go out and do like a strength and power type of a workout. But, you know, you have to be careful when you stretch because it can actually reduce performance depending on the event.
Yeah. Interesting. So one of the hypotheses that you were looking at was the idea that maybe stretching was not the best for performance, but it helped you mentally prepare for the event.
Yeah, I know. It was more of an affective kind of investigation where at times when we're preparing for an event or preparing for a practice, you know, we're always really trying to focus. I know some of your podcasts have kind of centered on the topic of focus and grit. And regardless of whether it's a workout or a game, and just mentally focusing before that can improve performance. And so what we found with one of our investigations was that you can actually reduce anxiety and improve self-efficacy, which is similar to like confidence, by doing a stretch prior to a workout or an event. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there may be, it kind of becomes a parity then when you would receive a affective benefit from stretching, but not necessarily a physiological benefit from stretching prior to an event. And, you know, Tim, you really have to consider the type of stretch because there is a static stretch, which we hold for about 30 seconds, and then there are ballistic stretches and dynamic stretches.
Mm-hmm.
And that also will have an impact on, you know, specifically physiologically outcomes, but may even have an impact on the affective outcomes.
Now, for years, people, though, have, let's say, supposedly experts have said that the best kind of stretching that you do is the gentle warm-up kind of stretch. You don't do ballistic stretching, and that kind of thought is changing recently, isn't it? I mean, what would you recommend?
Really, well, the shift has been more towards a dynamic stretch, which is, you know, the definition of a dynamic drift is basically trying to mimic the motion you're about to do. So what we would see is basically, you know, a 5 to 10 minute kind of a warm up. And so, you know, one of the examples I try and give my students is if you're about to go run the hurdle workout at the track, I think at one point if you've ever run the hurdles, your coach may have instructed you to do a hurdler stretch, which is, you know, you sit on the ground and put one knee out to the side and kind of lean forward. And
it hurts to think about that, actually, but go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, that's okay, but that's not really the preferred technique. The preferred technique would be to go actually put the hurdles at probably a lower height, practice like a lead leg and a trail leg drill over the hurdles, where you're actually getting the muscles involved in the range of motion that they'll be doing during exercise.
Yeah.
And you can emphasize or accentuate that range of motion and actually stretch. So that's a little more preferred at this point in most of the sports as a pre-exercise stretch, a dynamic stretch. But static stretching can also be beneficial as a post-workout kind of recovery, you know, maintaining your pliability and whatnot.
So your recommendation is that you do kind of a dynamic stretch to begin to and warm up, and then after your exercise, then you can start doing the static stretches.
That's about right. And really, you can do your static stretching, you know, later on in the day at a separate session. And that's, you know, when you can still get some of the recovery and injury prevention benefits from it.
Yeah.
And not necessarily take away from performance during the activity. So a lot of it also has to do, Tim, on the sport, where if you take a sport like gymnastics, in which you have to have a high amount of flexibility, obviously they're going to be spending a lot of time prior to the workout doing various stretches. So, but most team and strength and power sports and even endurance sports, the pre-exercise static stretch is not necessarily the recommendation at this point.
Well, it points up the fact that sports medicine in many cases is a lot more complicated. We know a lot more than we used to know. Some of the things that most of us think intuitively make sense really don't make sense from a scientific standpoint. And so if you aren't an exercise professional and you need to work with someone, you need to find someone who is qualified to help you in these areas.
Yeah, and these, you know, there's always constant research kind of confirming what we know, but you will still have, you know, various instances in which, you know, the scientists disprove what we are already doing. But at this point, most organizations consensually kind of have a position on stretching, so as far as what we previously discussed.
Yeah. We'll move from stretching to another type of stretch, and that is your health disparities research. And we'll talk about some of the specific examples, but for the audience, just define what we mean when we talk about health disparities.
Well, health disparities is really just kind of an umbrella term which refers to gaps in the healthcare system and healthcare practices and health behaviors. And those gaps traditionally exist across various demographic populations. So, you know, whether it's socioeconomic status, age, ethnicity, gender, there are differences in health accessibility, healthcare accessibility, and differences in health behaviors based which one of those categories you fall into. And, you know, what's been investigated, you know, health disparity research is relatively a recent field that the government, you know, kind of moved forward with the Office of Minority Health. I think in like 1986 that office was formed. And this was a kind of a byproduct that really didn't gain a lot of steam until I think the mid-2000s. And basically the goal of any health disparity work is to try and find those areas in which individuals are kind of disserviced or disadvantaged as far as receiving, you know, good health care or good opportunities to be, you know, physically active or proper nutrition or you know, even accessibility to the proper contraceptives.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of your work, interestingly enough, caught my eye as we were going through this, is that you've done work, you're talking about disparities in health behaviors. You have done a bit of work looking at body image in African-American collegiate cheerleaders and how that differs from European-American collegiate cheerleaders. Are you going to talk to us a little bit about that work?
Yes, body image is, you know, your perception of how you look. You know, if you see how you see yourself without really looking in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And that varies, you know, per age group and actually per ethnic group. And so obviously if you take a sport like cheerleading in which there is a high emphasis on aesthetics and a high emphasis on, you know, a large amount of power and a low weight, those individuals will already probably be in the at-risk category for possibly having, you know, a negative or distorted body image just because of the nature of their sport. But what we found was that body image perception varied specifically much different than white cheerleaders from black cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, we attribute that to obviously there's possible, you know, cultural preferences as far as what is the ideal body type, because that's essentially the discrepancy between what the way you perceive your body and what you think is the ideal body type. Hmm. And so that varies across cultures. Some cultures may, you know, prefer a larger female who has, you know, a taller stature. And So that was what some of that work was to investigate, because actually I had partnered with a cheer coach, and the cheer coach kept telling me that, he goes, I know my students would score different on your questionnaire than the white cheerleaders took the questionnaire, and that's what we actually confirmed that.
So you're saying that the African-American cheerleaders, they tended to reflect their cultural norms as did the European-American cheerleaders?
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense to him when you think about it, because, you know, whatever we think is the ideal body image, whether it's from what, you know, our peers try and portray, from what the media tries to portray, from what, you know, our society tries to portray, depending on the geography in which we live, you know, that varies. And so, yes, amongst African-American females, we noticed that body image actually wasn't, their scores were not as high as the white females, but the ideal type of body image that they were trying to achieve was a little larger in stature than the European American cheerleaders.
Interesting. What other examples of health disparities kind of information have you worked on, have you seen out there that you'd like to bring up?
Well, I think sometimes we have a perspective that everyone has access to be healthy and be active and proper nutrition, but when you go into certain populations or certain geographic locations, specifically like rural areas, inner city areas, and ethnic populations, you'll find that accessibility isn't as high. And, you know, we noticed this, or actually I noticed this upon arriving at this institution, that there just didn't seem to be an abundance of health-promoting opportunities for students. And so I curiously started to investigate, and I looked at what is already out there as far as at an institution in which the majority of the students are African-American. Mm. What are some of the health risk behaviors in this population? And I was totally shocked to find that there was not a lot of evidence, that those types of investigations had not been done. And so just that was one, what we consider gap, as far as the lack of assessment of any health risk behavior at a minority institution. And the health risk behaviors differ from a predominantly white institution versus a historically black institution. So, you know, one example would be alcohol use is much higher at a predominantly white institution than a historically black college.
Is it really?
In drunk driving reported, this is self-reported data that I'm referring to, but on average, alcohol use and drunk driving is actually higher at predominantly white institutions. But we also find that at historically black colleges and universities, the drug use is relatively the same as far as across marijuana use, but other illicit drugs are not as prevalent at HBCUs as they are at PWIs. And so, you know, the health risk behavior umbrella is so large, we can take any one of these health-promoting or health risk behaviors, such as accessibility to physical activity, and see if there are differences at these particular populations and which are intact at the universities.
Now, doing this research, is it thought that that can help correct some of these health disparities? Or, I mean, how do we wind up using this research to make a difference?
Well, first, just doing the research is a step in reporting it to individuals working in the community and individuals who have control over making some of those decisions, which can improve the accessibility to healthcare or health promoting behaviors. So, you know, I think that there's a long ways to go, and I think, you know, one of the most, at first it was discouraging, but then it became more, you know, I became more excited about making progress, was that at this particular minority institution, the continual health promoting opportunities for students was very limited, and versus when you go to larger schools with more, you know, more resources, more money, more accessibility. Mm-hmm. So just promoting awareness and then, you know, designing programs to improve behavior. If we notice that at a minority institution, those individuals are not using as contraceptives compared to the norms, then, you know, that would be an area that we'd develop a program for, so we can improve just, you know, safe sex practices amongst the student population. So sometimes as researchers and, you know, even sports scientists, we kind of get in our own little area working, and we don't necessarily think about the impact that it may have outside of our office or outside of our lab.
Right.
And what we've seen with the health disparity research is we've seen grants being funded, programs being developed, and overall student health opportunities improve. It's a really slow process.
Yeah. Changing a society always is, isn't it?
I mean, we can come in with the same argument with, you know, just general, you know, American populations in general. We can always find areas to improve health. And I think one of the frustrating parts, Tim, was I knew that we, at universities, you know, in which we have the knowledge, that if we had the knowledge, why isn't there an outcome, a positive outcome from having that knowledge? And so that was one of the gaps we sought to eliminate.
Yeah. Well, good. We are running short on time here, and very interesting conversation. But as we do with all of our guests, we're going to give you a chance here to give us your take-home message. If you had to give a take-home message that everyone would remember, what would that be?
I'd like the audience just to think that, or kind of consider that, you know, bad health doesn't discriminate no matter who you are. It's that behavioral component that we have to change. And so not everybody has the same opportunities that you and I may have. And at some point, you know, we have to try and level or equal the playing field for everyone to have access to good health.
Great. Great take-home message. And I'd like to thank you for being with us today. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Tim. It's been very enjoyable.
Great. And I'd like to thank all of you that are listening for taking the time to download us. And we do have a T-shirt question. Our T-shirt question today is, what is the best type of stretching to do before exercise in general? be the first one to send us the correct answer to that via email. Send it to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. And there are a bunch of those out there floating around now. You should see them. They're going to look great. Again, thank you all for taking the time to join us. We look forward to having you back next week when we have another interesting individual in sports medicine and human performance. Until next week, we hope you stay active and stay healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.